we could make a start, welcome everybody to this Dean's seminar that's going to be given by Philip Murphy, who's the new or relatively new director of the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. It's a great pleasure to introduce Philip. And of course, doing my research into his academic background has made me even more impressed than I was previously impressed by his performance as director. Philip has wide-ranging interests in 20th century history of Britain and the Commonwealth in particular in the 20th century, post-war British recolonisation. He has a particular angle that he approaches this from, which is that of the Conservative Party. He's also interested in the royal family, as you can see from the title of his speech today, post-war African politics, and intelligence history, British Commonwealth and US intelligence communities, and especially the activities of MI5 in the colonial empire. So perhaps we should invite him back to give another one on that, but today he's going to speak to us about the House of Windsor and the modern Commonwealth.
Thank you very much, Mike. I should explain that this paper rises out of my current research project, which is a book for Oxford University Press, very broadly on the monarchy, British monarchy and the post-war Commonwealth. And that embraces a number of different things, including the so-called Commonwealth realms, where the Queen is actually head of state, but also this nebulous concept of the headship of the Commonwealth. And it's that latter subject that I really want to concentrate on today, although I'm quite happy to take questions about more general aspects of the topic. And so my subsidiary title is Elizabeth II and the Unbearable Lightness of the Headship of the Commonwealth, or the Emperor's New Title. Now, this is the Dean's seminar, and our Dean, Mike Edwards, is a classicist. So as a tribute to him, I'd like to start off with a little bit of Latin translation. Just to set the background to this, the title Head of the Commonwealth emerges out of a conference in London of Commonwealth Prime Ministers in April 1949, which resolves the very pressing issue, what to do with India. India was determined to become a republic, and yet the thing that had bound the Commonwealth together up until that point was common allegiance to the crown. Could a republic be slotted into the Commonwealth, and could some link with the crown be achieved? And India's recognition of George VI as head of the Commonwealth was, if you like, a classic British fudge that got round this problem. But it's also the April 1949 declaration is often seen as the foundation stone of the modern Commonwealth. So, once this title had been agreed, the important task commenced of translating it into Latin. A very senior group of British civil servants, including the Cabinet Secretary, Sir Norman Brooke, met to discuss this vital issue in June 1949. A note on the meeting records that the Home Office had already explored the problem with a great number of classicists, quote, both in London and at the universities, unquote. And the Prime Minister himself had discussed the matter in the Senior Common Room at Oriel College, Oxford, during a recent visit. The distinguished group of mandarins considered various renderings of Commonwealth, rejecting outright the use of Republica on the grounds that, quote, the word could only have one connotation and the wrong one to the man in the street, unquote. A note on the meeting by one of the officials present went on to record, "The body of officials did not like the suggestion for head of the Commonwealth, which was civitatis gentium supremum caput." We all hated supremum caput, and none of us liked civitatis. Our objection to civitatis was partly that the first meaning of the word was citizenship, and the second meaning state. Partly that it didn't seem to us to mean an amalgam of states, which is what we denote by the word Commonwealth. I made the point that scholars in Canada and South Africa would almost certainly object to civitatis on the grounds that it suggested a superstate, which is not their conception of the Commonwealth. The meeting finally agreed the translation of the King's new title, of which head of the Commonwealth was rendered consortionis gentium princeps. The Whitehall Mandarins then submitted their text to Colin Hardy, a classicist at Magdalen College, Oxford, rather like a bunch of nervous schoolboys handing in their Latin homework. One of them recorded, Mr. Hardy said there was nothing wrong with the grammar of our translation, which was gratifying to a number of officials when the dim past didn't do too badly in honours mods. Hardy did have some reservations about the text, though, a couple of which related to the title head of the Commonwealth. According to one official, Mr. Hardy cordially accepted consortionis, which is a relief, but he disliked gentium, which he said connoted not nations but races. He therefore recommended populorum. The Mandarins meekly accepted this. They were not, however, prepared to accept Hardy's suggestion that princeps be changed to caput. One of them noted, "It may be that princeps has to the trained Latinist odd associations, but I do not myself feel that caput is a very honorific title for His Majesty the King." While further discussion of this matter was temporarily shelved on the advice of the Prime Minister, the Latin rendering head of the Commonwealth, which was ultimately agreed, was indeed consortionis populorum princeps. Hence, Mr. Hardy of Magdalen College, Oxford, better known as an expert on Virgil and Dante, also deserves to be remembered as co-author of the monarch's Latin title. There's something delightfully silly about this episode, but it does illustrate two points which have a considerable relevance to this paper. First, even in its Latin form, British officials were keen that the monarch's new title should not appear so substantial that it offended the more fiercely independent members of the Commonwealth. Secondly, officials were determined that the King's new role shouldn't undermine his prestige as a specifically British head of state. And we'll hear more about these dual concerns later. In effect, in constitutional terms, the British government presided over the creation of something that was about as close to nothing as it was possible to contrive. Then as now, the notion of the headship of the Commonwealth teetered on the verge of non-existence as surely as the transparent suit of clothes offered to the Emperor in Hans Christian Andersen's famous fable. The practice, of course, was quite different, and the heart of this story is really the tension between the Queen's efforts to give it substance and a distinct wariness on the part of Whitehall towards this constitutional minefield, and a growing hostility towards it on the part of sections of the British political class. The genesis of the headship of the Commonwealth and the London Declaration is very well documented. Indeed, it's become almost a sort of sacred foundation myth of the modern Commonwealth. But perhaps I could touch briefly on three important aspects of this process. First, the concept was the direct descendant of a form of words explicitly designed to exclude the crown from any meaningful role. Its progenitor was, as David McIntyre has recently noted, the Irish nationalist leader, Eamon de Valera. As early as his talks with the British government in November 1921, de Valera had seized upon the idea of the symbolism of the crown to suggest that Ireland could be associated with the British Commonwealth by recognising the crown as the symbol and accepted head of the association, rather than owing it direct allegiance. This notion found constitutional expression 15 years later in the Irish Free States External Relations Act, 1936, passed in the wake of the abdication crisis, which recognised the Crown purely for the purposes of diplomatic accreditation and international agreements. In the Act, the De Valera government expressed the Irish Free States' willingness to follow Commonwealth states in recognising the King as, quote, the symbol of their cooperation, unquote, but found no place for the concept of allegiance. The idea that the former without the latter could form a sufficient basis for Commonwealth membership would ultimately be embedded in the London Declaration of 1949. Malcolm MacDonald, who had been Secretary of State for the Dominions at the time of the passing of the External Relations Act, suggested to ministers in 1947 that it might provide a model to allow Burma to remain part of the Commonwealth. Yet Burma, of course, left the Commonwealth upon achieving independence in 1948, and later that year, Southern Ireland announced its own intention to leave the Commonwealth. With the fig leaf of external association no longer apparently viable, the British government began to contemplate an even more radical option. And here's my second point. In the months immediately preceding the London Declaration, the British government showed signs of being prepared to accept Commonwealth membership for a republic without any link to the Crown. In an influential paper drafted at the end of December 1948, Patrick Gordon Walker, the Parliamentary Under Secretary, the Commonwealth Relations Office, suggested focusing on the essential principle that, quote, India wants to be in the Commonwealth and all its other members want to accept her into membership. Could we not base ourselves on a Commonwealth relationship resting on the will and intent of all its members? Unquote. This would entail nothing less, Walker suggested, than, quote, the deliberate and friendly snapping of the Crown link by mutual consent and the simultaneous absorption of a completely non-monarchical dominion into the Commonwealth, a dominion that genuinely and sincerely wishes to remain in the Commonwealth. The advantages of the clean break might include, Walker suggested, the possibility of the Irish Republic and Burma actually returning to the Commonwealth. Gordon Walker subsequently retreated from this position in the face of Commonwealth consultations in March 1949, which suggested somewhat misleadingly that Pakistan, Ceylon and South Africa were likely to raise serious objections to India remaining in the Commonwealth without any link to the Crown. He was also swayed by indications that Nehru would be prepared to reach a compromise around the idea of the King becoming head of the Commonwealth. Yet, and here's my third point, the British government ultimately settled for a formulation of that role, which was even less substantial than that implied by the Irish concept of external association. At the London Conference of April 1949, the South African Prime Minister, D.F. Milan, famously objected that the title head of the Commonwealth might imply the Commonwealth itself was a constitutional entity, a notion that South Africa would find it difficult to accept. Milan's reservations were addressed in two ways. First, the words as such were inserted into the final declaration, so that it spoke of India's, quote, acceptance of the King, a symbol of the free association of its independent members, and as such, head of the Commonwealth. This was in itself a significant weakening of the concept of the headship, although one that partly met Patrick Gordon Walker's earlier objection that the Commonwealth, by its nature, being a free association of independent sovereign nations, couldn't really have a head as such. Secondly, it was agreed that it should specifically be put on record that the title didn't imply that the King discharged any constitutional function by virtue of the headship. But one of the interesting things about this meeting, one of the reasons why it continues to be a tricky issue, is that the ministers present didn't really give much thought to the question of whether this role should be hereditary. There's very little in the written record, either in the National Archives or in the Royal Archives, on this. I suppose that the key statement we have is part of a report on the legal aspects of the agreement by John Rowlatt, a parliamentary counsel to the Treasury. And Rowlatt said basically this: look, you can't have a law of succession for the headship of the Commonwealth because there isn't a body capable of passing laws for the Commonwealth as a whole, QED. And in a way, I mean, this is a ruling that Vernon Bogdaner quotes, and it's pretty much the accepted line now that the role was never really meant and never could be hereditary. Although David McIntyre is a dissenter in this, and he raises some interesting objections, which I don't really have time to go into now, but I'd like to come back to, suggesting that the ministers in April 1949 might have just accepted that it would be hereditary. In practice, the only time this has arisen, of course, was on the death of George VI in 1952. And then the issue was decided through a series of bilateral negotiations between London and the Commonwealth States. And essentially, the title was automatically passed on to Elizabeth II because Nehru agreed to it. So in a sense, Nehru creates this role in many ways and also ensures that it is passed to George VI's successor. When the new royal title was finally embodied in statute in the Royal Stamp Titles Bill of 1953, Enoch Powell, then a Tory backbencher, whom we'll hear far more of in this paper, took a lone stand against the title, particularly the concept of the headship of the Commonwealth. In doing so, he earned a rebuke from David Maxwell Fyfe, the Home Secretary of the day. And yet, as on many other occasions, Powell's public criticisms found echoes in private discussions in Whitehall and in the palace. A briefing paper produced by the Commonwealth Relations Office shortly before the Queen's coronation noted that no attempt had yet been made, quote, to define the practical significance of the conception thus accepted by India, and admitted that there was much force in Powell's comment that, quote, the status of India resulting from these changes and declarations is ungraspable in law and in fact, unquote. It also admitted that as matters stood, India's relationship to the Crown could only be defined in negative terms. The Queen was not India's head of state. India owed no allegiance to her, and all the constitutional functions performed by her in other Commonwealth countries were, in India's case, performed by its president. The palace was, at least in the 1950s, adamant that the Queen's position as head of the Commonwealth was an entirely symbolic one. As her private secretary, Michael O'Dean, noted in September 1959, quote, no constitutional function was attached to it at the time of the London Declaration, and none can belong to it now, because no head of the Commonwealth could act in a Commonwealth sense without constitutional advisers, and no such constitutional advisers exist. Indeed, other Commonwealth members had been keen to ensure that it did remain purely symbolic, and they policed this matter vigorously. Two examples. In 1956, Commonwealth Prime Ministers were consulted by the British government over a proposal to confer the title Prince of the Commonwealth on the Duke of Edinburgh. The Canadian Prime Minister, amongst others, objected to the proposal, claiming that the title was inappropriate, since the Commonwealth had no government and therefore could have no titles attached to it. A year later, as Michael Dean later recalled, quote, it was tentatively suggested that when the Queen addressed the United Nations in New York, she might do so as head of the Commonwealth and speak from a text approved or acquiesced in by the various Commonwealth Prime Ministers. The South African government lost no time in dissociating itself from this suggestion and made it clear that exception would be taken to its being adopted by other governments. It was dropped. Tensions over this issue between the palace and the British government really only started to surface from the 1960s onwards. And I think you can see why this should be the case. The period from, say, 1961 to 1973 saw a radical transformation in Britain's relationship with the Commonwealth. More precisely, a pronounced rupture. It's had a number of elements. Firstly, rapid decolonisation and the focus on sanctions against Rhodesia and then South Africa changed the whole nature of Commonwealth meetings and made them really quite uncomfortable for British ministers. One had the decision in 1968 to withdraw east of Suez, a kind of drawing back of British forces. One had the British attempts to join the EEC, culminating in entry in 1973. One had a corresponding decline in the importance to Britain of trade with the Commonwealth. One had successive Commonwealth Immigration Acts from 1962 onwards, and a fierce and impassioned domestic debate within Britain about Commonwealth immigration. And one had administrative but nonetheless significant changes, principally the absorption in 1968 of the Commonwealth Relations Office into the Foreign Office. A sign that these changes might lead to tensions with the British government, and particularly with Conservative administrations, came as early as 1964. In the second of three anonymous articles written by Enoch Powell in the Times under the pseudonym A Conservative, Powell famously denounced the Commonwealth as, quote, a gigantic farce. He sought to strip bare what he regarded as the delusions surrounding the Commonwealth, not least of which was the role of the Crown. Powell complained, quote, if the monarchy is a precious and irreplaceable heritage of the British people, and most Conservatives believe it is, it's dangerous to prostitute to the service of a transparent fiction the subtle emotions of loyalty and affection on which that heritage depends. A great and growing number of people of these islands do not like to see the sovereign, whom they regard as their own by every claim of history and sentiment, playing an alien part as one of the characters in the Commonwealth charade. Very famous article. What was interesting was to go back to a little file which the Commonwealth Relations Office opened on this. And inevitably, senior civil servants were throwing their hands up, saying, this is outrageous, this is abominable, how can you say something like that? It's so true, it's unfair. And at the end of this long minute sheet is a little minute by Secretary of State for Commonwealth Relations, Duncan Sands, which says simply, I do not like it, but it contains much that is unfortunately true. The problem was, of course, that meanwhile the Queen herself was keen to build up this role of head of the Commonwealth and give it some substance. And this was done in a number of ways, a few of which themselves are of great significance, but collectively really added up to something. Just go through them very, very quickly. 1966 saw the launch of the first multi-faith service on Commonwealth Day, very much encouraged by the palace. Took place at St. Martin in the Fields Church in London, and almost immediately ran into trouble with the bishops. The Archbishop of Canterbury told Downing Street, it really makes a nonsense of the whole concept of Anglicanism if Hindus and Muslims are invited to take part in an Anglican religious ceremony. Next year it didn't take place, the year after it was moved to the Guildhall, and finally in 1972, it was moved to Westminster Abbey, which is a royal peculiar, i.e. it's under the control of the Queen. The Bishop of London and the Archbishop of Canterbury have nothing to do with it, so it's not their business. So she kind of, the palace almost takes ownership of this in an interesting way. There's the Commonwealth Games, which is fertile ground for invented traditions around the Commonwealth, starting in 1958 with the Queen's Relay, whereby the Queen gives a baton to a runner, and there's a relay, and it's finally handed to either the Queen or her representative, who reads a speech taken out of the baton. It's now very high tech. The Queen gave the baton to the first of the relays in October to be taken to the Delhi Commonwealth Games next year, and we're told that it actually has a device inside so you can text goodwill messages to the runners. This is a modern Commonwealth. Relations with high commissioners. The Queen has gone out of her way to give special treatment to Commonwealth High Commissioners at royal receptions, ceremonial events. And it's very interesting, one of the few signs you get in the National Archives of the Queen's personal expressions of opinion. In 1968, when the Commonwealth Relations Office was merged with the Foreign Office, the Queen very pointedly expressed the hope that, quote, this would not in any way diminish the special arrangements made for Commonwealth representatives. Another aspect is relations with the Commonwealth Secretariat. There was, in a sense, a kind of a pact between Commonwealth Secretary Generals and the palace to build up each other's roles. Secretary Generals to build up the Queen's roles at the Commonwealth, and for the Queen to build up the role of Secretary General after its establishment in 1965, because both, in a sense, have been established on quite minimalist bases. And the Queen, in a way, invited the Secretary General of the Commonwealth to act as a Commonwealth advisor, if only in an informal sense. The Secretary General, meanwhile, provided the Queen with further means to play a Commonwealth role, particularly through the Commonwealth Heads of Government meetings. The Queen's attended most of them, and from the 1990s to 1987, she's actually given a formal address to them at the invitation of the Commonwealth Secretary. Her attendance at Commonwealth Heads of Government meetings has been quite controversial at times, and again has led to tensions with the British government, particularly under the premiership of Edward Heath. When the Conservatives were elected to office in 1970, one of the first things they did was to announce that they were resuming arms sales to South Africa. That meant that the 1971 Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Singapore was likely to be a turbulent affair, with the British government coming to us over all the flag. The Queen was due to go to Singapore, and in the end, Heath explicitly advised her, told her, in fact, not to go. It's clear from the correspondence, because he didn't want her to be at the centre of the storm. Thought it might damage her prestige, and might, you know, add to the fuel to the flames. From the correspondence, it's very clear that the Queen, the palace, were not happy with this at all. Although the palace accepted Heath's decision as it had to, the Queen's private secretary told Downing Street very pointedly, quote, it was the Queen's considered opinion that when there is a meeting of this nature, it is desirable, and indeed it is her duty as head of the Commonwealth, to be present. Now, I think as we've seen, that was rather pushing at the margins of constitutional reality. It's a very clear sign of how important she saw these things. The Queen, the Common Secretary, got their own back. Heath was not even very keen, after having duly been given a hammering at the Singapore Heads of Government meeting were not at all keen that there should be any further Heads of Government meetings. Didn't particularly want one to take place in 1973, and certainly didn't want the Queen to attend. He was the victim of a pincer movement between the Commons Secretariat and the Palace. The Commons Secretary General, Arnold Smith, approached the Canadian Prime Minister, Pierre Trudeau, and said, would you like to host the next Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Canada? Trudeau said yes, and then invited the Queen to attend as Queen of Canada. So, Heath had absolutely no say in the matter, constitutionally, and the Queen went. And there was a sort of terse little minute from the Foreign Office that the British Prime Minister was perturbed by the Queen's decision to accept as Queen of Canada. I bet he was. I mean, it's very easy to kind of caricature Heath as this sort of grumpy Europhile with a grudge against the Commonwealth. And no doubt he was all of these things. The problem was that there was a, you know, there was a genuine issue for British governments over this sort of thing. It had two aspects. Firstly, although in theory Britain was just one member of the Commonwealth of which the Queen was head, anything done or said by the Queen in the Commonwealth capacity was likely to have implications for Britain's international relations. This is because whatever the official Commonwealth doctrine, she remained, in the eyes of most people in the world, the Queen of England. Secondly, there was a concern that her domestic prestige as Britain's own national figurehead might be affected by this Commonwealth role. And these problems were confounded by uncertainties about the extent to which the British government was able to advise the Queen on her Commonwealth role. A very good example of this is the Queen's Christmas Day broadcast. The issue has twice attracted significant public controversy. Once in 1969, when the palace decided there should be no broadcast message at all. And again in 1983. The 1983 broadcast followed the Queen's attendance at that year's Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in India. And in the broadcast, she referred to the gap between rich and poor, which seemed to many conservative commentators a case of the Queen championing Commonwealth interests against the policy of her own government. It drew from, yes indeed, Enoch Powell, the suggestion that she had been badly advised. The historian and constitutional expert, Lord Blake, who was close to the palace, stepped into the subsequent debate with a reminder that the Christmas Day and Commonwealth Day messages were the only two occasions when the Queen spoke without ministerial advice. This didn't satisfy Powell, unsurprisingly, who demanded to know when the convention about the two annual messages was declared and which ministers were responsible for it. Quote, remembering that advice is not requisite, is also advice, unquote. This bizarre exchange was brought to a suitably surreal end by Blake, who replied, quote, if ministerial advice is not needed, ministerial advice that is not needed is also not needed. In fact, the situation was, in practice, far more complex than this. The standard doctrine was indeed that when the Queen gave her Commonwealth Day message, she was speaking to the Commonwealth as a whole and therefore did not expect British ministerial advice. But this, of course, put Prime Ministers in an invidious position, particularly in the light of a separate ruling by the palace in 1957, that notwithstanding this, the British government was responsible for anything the Queen might say in the Christmas broadcast. Recognising the difficulties in which this placed the British government, the palace proved willing to go beyond simply providing British Prime Ministers with a text of the message as a courtesy. It allowed British Prime Ministers to give advice on particular issues which were considered likely to impinge on British national interests. The question is, what was meant by this? Potentially everything could. One example, in the broadcast of 1972, the Queen proposed to mention the situation in Northern Ireland and Britain's forthcoming entry into the EEC. Both were considered matters on which the palace, by the palace, in which the British government could legitimately give advice. And indeed, Heath appears to have regarded himself as being in a position to approve what the Queen said on these matters. The text was also shown to the Northern Ireland office. There was no convention, however, that the Prime Minister should be consulted on whether the broadcast should take place at all. And in 1969, when it was decided that no broadcast should take place, not only was Downing Street not consulted, but the BBC was told before Harold Wilson was told. And this, of course, put him in a very difficult position. The decision was likely to be controversial, and whatever Wilson did or didn't do, it was likely to be damaged politically. If the Queen changed her mind as a result of his advice, the BBC would know that Downing Street had intervened and might publicise the matter. If he did nothing, Wilson might well be accused, in the words of his private secretary, of, quote, intervening to keep her off the television so you can hog it, unquote. In the event, Wilson didn't intervene, the broadcast didn't go ahead, and there was a great deal of criticism, most of it, in fact, aimed at the palace. Just to confuse matters further in terms of precedent, in 1968, the Queen's Christmas Day broadcast was devoted almost entirely simply to Commonwealth affairs. The Queen's private secretary, Michael Dean, learned, one can tell he was a little bit nervous about this, that instead of getting someone from outside the palace to write the speech, the Queen and Prince Philip had done it themselves. And indeed, it looked like Prince Philip had done most of it. And on this basis, a text was shown to the Under Secretary of State, Paul Gough Booth, at the Foreign Office. He was clearly rather embarrassed by this, didn't like it very much, didn't feel he could say anything, though, and let it pass. So in terms of constitutional precedent, I think we can safely say that any Queen's Christmas Day broadcast that is written by Prince Philip is legitimately a course for British ministerial advice. Briefly, the future of the headship. Discussions went on in the Foreign Office, certainly in the 1970s, and have probably gone on regularly ever since, about what to do about the future. If it's not sustainable for the headship to remain within the House of Lords, what to do about it? The problem of it not being in the hands of the British royal family is, first, if it's supposed to be a symbolic role, how could anyone else and who could symbolise the Commonwealth equally or differently? Secondly, if not the Queen, then who was to fulfil the role? If it was going to be a Commonwealth head of government, how long would they hold it for? If the period was too short, there would be no continuity. If it was too long, even a year, then many Commonwealth states would have to wait 40, 50 years now before a member of their government held the post. And of course, there was a usual thing in the 70s, but what if it was Idi Amin or some other undesirable Commonwealth head of state? How is this rotation to work? etc., etc. There was an interesting occasion, actually in the 1990s, when the issue was very nearly resolved in favour of the House of Windsor. This followed Mozambique entering the Commonwealth in 1995, which raised all sorts of questions about the criteria for membership. Previously, countries had entered the Commonwealth basically because they'd been part of the British Empire. They had some concrete constitutional link to the UK. Once Mozambique was allowed to join, the question is, what is the criteria for membership, if not that? And a special intergovernmental group on the criteria for Commonwealth membership was set up, which reported to the 1997 Commonwealth Heads of Government, which met in Edinburgh. The group's findings were received and endorsed by the heads of government, although they don't seem to have discussed it at any great length. And the issue, the Commission's finding on the question of the headship of the Commonwealth, didn't appear in the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting communique. On the issue of what prospective members needed to do, one of the recommendations of the group is that they should recognise, quote, the British monarch as head of the Commonwealth. Now, it was clear at the press conference after the 1997 Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting that a lot of heads of government, including Tony Blair, didn't really recognise the full implications of this term British monarch. But they were, of course, profound. If prospective members had to recognise the British monarch, it meant that the British monarch was head of the Commonwealth, rather than George VI or the Queen in her personal capacity. Therefore, it would pass to the next British monarch. Therefore, it was hereditary. Whether this was intentional, is it conspiracy, is it cock-up? I've heard lots of different accounts, and maybe one or two people in the audience I can see who would probably know more about it than I do. Suffice to say, when this issue was returned to the September 2007 the 2007 Heads of Government meeting in Kampala, and criteria for membership were set out, it was made very clear that applicants would have to recognise, quote, Queen Elizabeth II as head of the Commonwealth. So, the issue of whether it was hereditary was thrown open again. So, I suppose the big question is, what happens on the Queen's death to the headship of the Commonwealth? Luckily, of course, I'm just a historian. I deal with the past and not the future. So I think I'll leave it there. But I will answer questions on this. Thank you very much.
Perhaps it is incumbent upon you to investigate this further, which was an undiplomatic remark. In contrast to the first 5 minutes of extremely diplomatic remarks, which indicate, I think, very clearly why Philip is not only elected as the head of the Commonwealth Studies, but is doing such a great job in that position. Now, I won't let classics take over the whole discussion, but I've got some questions of my own, but perhaps I can throw this open to more people who are more au fait with the topic to ask some questions.
Can I just ask a question about one of the things you said? So you've got this problem, are they to see the head as the individual or the role?
Yeah.
The role or the realizer, and at the moment it's been the realizer of the role in the life succession.
Yeah.
And when you mooted the possibility of alternative options, you said, well, trouble with it being a very short rotation, suppose it's the head of each of the Commonwealth countries and it's very short rotation, you lose continuity. But I wondered, continuity of what? Because if it's a ceremonial role and function,
yeah,
it's not obvious that you can do much to disrupt it. I mean, if you think there is something that's being done to preserve continuity or to establish something more that's not just emerging from the members willing it, then it's got more substance than you were initially letting us think. So I was wanting to press you a little bit on what you meant by continuity.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with the headship of the Commonwealth is that it's not just a ceremonial role. That at its heart is the notion that the Queen is the symbol of the free association of Commonwealth members. And I think that raises a lot of problems in itself in terms of the future. This is one of my little party pieces at Cumberland Lodge, and I'm all rich and fancy with it again. But I mean that when you're kind of in the sort of late 40s. You can talk about, or late 40s, early 50s, there is this kind of reverence attached to the monarchy, reverence attached to the crown. Attlee writes this extraordinary letter to Nehru in March 1949, really a sort of last-ditch attempt to prevent India from becoming a republic. And he says something to the effect that, look, you know that it's the royal family, it's the symbol of the family, which people around the world can understand. And he says it's not going too far to compare it to the holy family. You know, they don't see, you know, Mary, Jesus, and Joseph as Jews, but as, you know, as Dutch in Holland and as, you know, Chinese in China. You know, and you know, there's this kind of British Shintoism in the air, and the Round Table Journal describes the coronation of Elizabeth II as a sublime religious experience. It's very, very difficult to imagine anyone nowadays talking about the royal family in such reverential terms. But that is, you know, that is the key to the notion of that being the symbol of Commonwealth Association. And I mean that in recent years, the Commonwealth has trailed this post of chairperson in office, almost one suspects, to see whether it might act as some kind of surrogate for the headship. That the head of government who hosts the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting for the next 2 years to the next one is chair in office and will perform certain high-level functions on behalf of the Commonwealth. But, you know, almost inevitably, this hasn't worked. It may have worked in certain senses, but it hasn't worked in any way that suggests that it would be a viable alternative to the head of the Commonwealth, because those leaders are necessarily controversial political characters, both on the international scene and within their own countries. And I think there's a general consensus in many respects that the chair in office hasn't been a great success. So, you know, that's the thing. You could say that, well, yes, you know, you could beef up the role of the Commonwealth Secretary General to pursue these kind of ceremonial functions. But the idea of the head as a symbol of the Commonwealth and symbol of the Commonwealth Association makes it very difficult to imagine a viable alternative.
I really enjoyed that, Philip, and it's very gratifying to know that one of my colleagues is dealing with similar things that I'm dealing with in the 19th century, right down to the Latin and all that business. So I suppose inevitably my question is about the pre-1949 era, because it seems to me there's a danger that in this subject you treat the Commonwealth as some kind of monolith, whereas many individual member states within the Commonwealth have very different traditions and indeed different languages in relation to monarchies. So the British North America Act of 1867 gives you one kind of dominion status. The New Zealand situation is different. The irony of India becoming a republic is that this is the one part of the empire where you have had a formal and cleverly crafted proclamation about what was the relationship of the monarchy to India from 1858 onwards. So I really wondered whether this is partly a story about individual Commonwealth states having prior vocabularies of sovereignty before 1949, and then there's after 49 there's a jockeying for position, or there's conflict and contest between individual states over what this one unique relationship should be thereafter.
No, I mean, I think the interesting thing is, again, talking about continuities, there's danger in talking about the modern Commonwealth and seeing 1949 as an absolute watershed, when it, because of India, I mean, to acceptance of Burma before, this issue suddenly becomes terribly controversial. And indeed, in the earlier 20th century, it was a huge problem, and for the British, you know, particularly because of the attitude of the South African government and the government of the Irish Free State. And it, you know, I mentioned de Valera, but you could say that, you know, Herzog in South Africa is the other kind of midwife of the modern Commonwealth, in stressing sovereign independence, in stressing the doctrine of the divisibility of the crown. And so, you know, never mind 1947-49, you know, in 1936, to stress this point, the Irish High Commissioner doesn't attend the accession proclamation, makes a sort of symbolic stand that Ireland's outside. Doesn't owe allegiance to the crown. The South African High Commissioner very nearly doesn't attend. And indeed, the South African High Commissioner doesn't attend the Accession Council in 1952 to make this point about South Africa's sovereign independence. And this in a way is one of the great paradoxes, that there's a sense amongst the British that monarchy should be the glue that brings everything together. In terms of the dominions, this kind of language of race about allegiance amongst people of British stock, which is always wheeled out. But again, that makes it all the more controversial symbol when you're dealing with Afrikaners, when you're dealing with Irish nationalists. And there's also this kind of sense that, you know, the peoples of the empire, the peoples of the Commonwealth, because they are, you know, in many cases tribal, because they have these quasi-religious leaders of the traditional leaders of their own, will necessarily feel a natural affinity for the British monarch. And again, that's often far from being the case. And so that, you know, almost throughout the 20th century, well, you know, in the first half of the 20th century, the monarch is a force for division, frankly, within the Empire Commonwealth, as much as it is a force for unity. Yeah.
Thank you. I think my question is probably very closely related to that. And it's, I suppose, you know, was the London Declaration too clever by half? Mm. That it papered over too many differences of perspective amongst those represented. It strikes me that, in a lot of ways, what the 1949 Declaration signalled is that the Commonwealth had become pretty much a self-governing organisation that made its own rules. And several of the countries came away from that, particularly perhaps Australia and New Zealand, not perhaps realising that. I mean, actually it even uses two terms, doesn't it? It uses Commonwealth in one place and British Commonwealth in another, which was another point of disagreement in the late 1940s. And I suppose all those plans for two-tier Commonwealths, you know, went right through to at least the 60s, in some ways reflect this. I mean, the Trudeau story talks very interesting because it was a pincer movement. It was a pincer movement only made possible because for a number of Commonwealth countries, still in the 1970s, the Queen was performing yet another function. She was still head of state. So I'm just wondering if the origins of all these problems are effectively in the very strange... I mean, even George VI joked about it, didn't he? About the as such bit.
It was a great
amusement to him. I mean, it was just too clever. Too many committees sitting for too long over 2 or 3 years to come up with a formulation that probably mightn't have been worth formulating.
Yeah. Well, I keep on, as you've heard, I keep on going back to that Patrick Gordon Walker memorandum at the end of 1948. And you think, God, it would be so much easier if they'd just stuck to that. In a way, there's a miscalculation there. Because when Gordon Walker takes soundings, the British Governor General takes soundings in March 1949, they come to the impression that South Africa in particular will cause problems if there's any attempt to fit into the Commonwealth as a republic. I mean, actually, one of the most striking things about the 1849 conference is how accommodating Malan is, D.F. Malan. He's almost along with Nehru, he's almost the hero of the conference in saying, look, the Commonwealth is about other things than allegiance to the crown. And of course, Malan has his own domestic reasons for saying that. But you know, with a little bit of courage, you feel the British government could have pressed ahead on this notion of the Commonwealth being bound essentially by the will of its members to associate, and that is still what holds it together. And the fact that countries from outside the Commonwealth still want to join. This desire to associate is really what holds everything together. And it might have been far easier if the issue of the crown, hadn't been thrown into this. I mean, the elephant in the room, of course, and the reason why the British government are really sort of trying anything and end up going for what they see as the safest option is the whole Cold War issue around India. The British still believe, despite all the indications that India will become non-aligned, they still believe that they will have, if India is part of the Commonwealth, Britain will have access to India's military resources in a Cold War sense. And indeed, when Attlee is writing to the palace justifying this move, he justifies it very largely in Cold War terms. What it would be a great danger for us if India is excluded from the Commonwealth. The interesting thing when you go to the Royal Archives is actually how little say the palace seems to have had in it, or how little influence it seems to have exerted. I mean, of course, one never knows, so one never sees a catalogue. But the stuff that they deign to produce for you. It doesn't suggest that the palace was taking a leading role in this at all.
Philip, I just wanted to query the 1997 decision in that report from the committee chaired by the New Zealand High Commission that it should be the British monarch who was the head of the Commonwealth. And you were saying you'd heard lots of rumours as to how that formulation might have come about.
Yeah.
My own suspicion, for what it's worth, is that the then Secretary General of the Commonwealth, Chief Emeka Rangiora, was a tremendous royalist. And the then High Commissioner of New Zealand was either a royalist himself or rather ignorant about these issues, and it was quite easy for the Secretary General to push the line that it was not in the person of Queen Elizabeth, but actually it went with the monarchy. And I really just wanted to know a little bit about your own views and whether we can actually get to the truth of this, because I think it is quite important, and I think it's very important that it was then reversed 10 years later. At the more recent Kampala charter. And just by the way, I mean, I think that the whole issue of the headship is, although at one level it's very arcane, at another level it does go to the heart of the British involvement with the Commonwealth. And secondly, this point that you made rather vividly about the way there was, from 1965 onwards, a mutual interest in the Commonwealth Secretary General and the Commonwealth Secretary and the palace building up both the role of the Secretary-General and the role of the head of the Commonwealth, I think is very interesting, very telling, and absolutely right. But on the question of the 1997, I just wondered whether you had any more information or as to how that particular formulation of the British monarch crept into a document, which was then endorsed, but was then abolished 10 years later. It's marvellous the Commonwealth can do things and then unsay them.
Because they didn't include it in the communique, I suppose. Otherwise, it might have been considered fixed. It's very difficult to get beyond the level of rumour and counter-rumour on this. A number of people, like you, suggest that Anuku was driving this forward because Anuku was a monarchist. What's rather interesting is that if he was then, he wasn't necessarily early in his career. There's some interesting correspondence in the Foreign Office from 1973. And Anuku, who was then a sort of a more junior civil servant in the Secretariat, has talks with the Foreign Office suggesting that this requirement on countries that become republics to reapply for Commonwealth membership should be dropped, saying this was an anachronism in the modern world. We'll come back to that. I mean, I think it's an interesting point. It may be less that Anuku's changed, but that the importance to the monarchy, the importance of Elizabeth II to the Commonwealth, has changed and increased in those subsequent decades. It's very difficult to get beyond this. I mean, I've spoken to David McIntyre about it, who, of course, was one of the few people at that press conference to notice. And I think it was David who put the question to Tony Blair about this term British monarch, and Blair just looked blankly back at him. He clearly had other things on his mind. John Colling, the New Zealand High Commissioner who authored that report, actually, I think even before the report was submitted, had written an article in Round Table about it, really trailing a lot of its recommendations. I don't quite know why he did that. But again, reading the article, it's not really clear that Colling recognised the implications of that, because at some points he uses the term British monarch, at some points he uses the term Elizabeth II. One slightly suspects from that he actually wasn't quite up to speed on the terminology.
That's one point. Actually, it means that there are symbolic gaps in the current stage, like. There are no viable alternatives to some symbols. Is that correct? And is there any development you perceive with this situation? Like, are there any viable alternatives to some symbols?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's encouraging me to move into very half-baked territory, because I have my own little ideas, but I don't think that. I think that the key problem is the head of the Commonwealth as a symbol of the association. And I think it's very difficult, as I said before, for a head of government or a former head of government, unless you're dealing with a sort of semi-deified figure like Mandela, to occupy that role. And I suspect most people would probably say that, you know, Prince Charles was maybe not suitable to fulfill that role. And of course, you know, the Commonwealth experts from the room will know this already, but there was quite recently, last year, this document produced by the Royal Commonwealth Society called Commonwealth Conversation, which is really a survey across six different Commonwealth countries of what they felt about the Commonwealth, and they touched on things like the headship of the Commonwealth. And indeed, the Foreign Office sponsored this document, and it came up with all sorts of interesting findings. In India, only 15% of those questioned supported Charles becoming the next head of the Commonwealth, compared with 50% in favour of rotating headship. And in Jamaica, President Obama was a more popular candidate than Charles. I'm not entirely convinced by this kind of method. I mean, you could do this as a demolition job on almost any institution. Do it on the cabinet, the UK Independence Party, the European Commission. Do a survey, and you'll find that the outcome is don't know, don't care, or something along those lines. You'll find some rather weird. But I mean, it does point to a problem in the way that the Prince of Wales is perceived. I mean, one possible half-baked option, if one wants to go down this route of the headship of the Commonwealth, is to have something like a kind of College of Commonwealth Laureates, to give a something like a Nobel Prize every year to an outstanding figure in the Commonwealth, maybe an artist, writer, academic, and maybe sort of build up a college of six or seven laureates, Commonwealth laureates, who could fulfill sort of ceremonial functions, and at the same time, through their lives and through their achievements, symbolise the ideals of the Commonwealth. I mean, that you know, if one wants to go down that road of maintaining symbolic head, that seems like a maybe a viable option. Jay?
Yeah, just that last comment of yours reminded me that I think last week Gordon Brown hosted British Nobel Prize laureates, and there was some not controversy, but some interest in the Indian press that Amartya Sen, who has always insisted that he remains an Indian national, and as far as I know is an Indian national, was amongst those invited along with another Indian national based in the United States. So, what I wanted to ask you about was, again, going back to 1949 and the royal family's attitude towards all this. And you give, you suggest that they largely stayed out of the debate. And I was wondering about Mountbatten and whether, because he had strong views on all kinds of things, and having just returned from India as Governor General, have you come across anything that he might have said any position that he took on this?
There's nothing, there isn't very much in the world. I mean, when I was looking through the papers in the World Archives, there's a certain amount of correspondence between Mountbatten and the King about the Indian Army again, and which again rather reinforces the point that this, the idea of access to India's military might was at the back of a lot of people's thoughts. No sense of Mountbatten getting involved at this point that I've seen in the correspondence. Although I think he is consulted in March 1949 and plays some part in those discussions, sounding out Commonwealth members. But I have to go back. I mean, I wrote a little article about Mountbatten's future, I mean, subsequent role in the Commonwealth, and this rather odd attempt in 1965, which he heads up, to set up a Commonwealth Bilderberg group, in a sense to turn the Commonwealth back into a cosy, secretive little gentleman's club. And so he's certainly a very interesting figure in the Commonwealth times, but I don't think he was pivotal there.
Well, if there are no further questions, it seems ironic to me that Prince Charles should be so unpopular as a leader of the Commonwealth, and his own motto is "I serve." I'll ask you afterwards about Prinkhaus. What was George VI's attitude to being called Prinkhaus, not Rex or Captain? That's the whole background, of course, to the word Prinkhaus, to avoid being called the monarch.
Well, he did.
A Republican.
I mean, we mentioned it before, and they're dealing with the account of him commenting on this. Is he very amused by this phrase, "as such head of the Commonwealth"? He goes around and saying to people, "So what am I now? As such."
Okay, well, thank you again for a gripping and revealing account of intrigue, a rather different and, for me, rather more interesting kind from the normal. Thank you once again.